This is Dick Estelle's Radio Reader. I'm Bob Page. Because of serious health issues, Dick is unable to continue the reading of Rogue Lawyer and has asked me to complete the reading of this, the last Radio Reader's book. Dick is so grateful and touched by the hundreds of emails and letters sent by his loyal listeners, and he would love to hear from you. Contact information is available on the homepage of the Radio Reader website at radioreader.net. Now let's continue with John Grisham's Rogue Lawyer, published by Doubleday of New York in 2015. In the last reading, Taddeo has turned down the plea bargain against Sebastian Rudd's advice. As we resume, Max Mancini, the prosecutor, is making his opening statement. The defendant sitting right over there will try and confuse you, try and convince you that the law makes exceptions for people who temporarily or permanently lose their minds. Baloney. He rambles on a bit without notes, and I've known for some time that Max gets in trouble when he goes off script. The more skilled courtroom advocates convey the impression that they are speaking extemporaneously, while in truth they've spent hours memorizing and rehearsing. Max is not one of those, but he's not as bad as most prosecutors. He does a very smart thing by promising the jurors that they will soon see the now famous video. He makes them wait. He could, even at this initial stage of the trial, show the video. Go slow has already said so, but he teases them with it. Nice move. His opening statement is not long because his case is ironclad. Impulsively, I stand and tell Her Honor that I will reserve my opening statement until the beginning of our defense, an option under our rules. Max bounces forth and calls as his first witness the widow, Mrs. Beverly King. She's a nice-looking lady, dressed for church and terrified of the witness chair. Max walks her through the standard sympathy ritual, and within minutes, she's in tears. Though such testimony has nothing at all to do with guilt or innocence, it's always allowed to hammer home the fact that the deceased is indeed dead and that he or she left behind loved ones. Sean was a faithful partner, devoted father, hard worker, breadwinner, loving son to his dear mother. Between sobs, we get the picture, and as always, it's dramatic. The jurors swallow it whole, and a few glare at Taddeo. I've yelled at him not to look at the jurors, but instead sit attentively at the table and scribble nonstop on a legal pad. Do not shake your head. Do not show any reaction or emotion. At any given time, at least two members of the jury are looking at you. I do not cross-examine Mrs. King. She's excused and returns to her seat next to her three children in the front row. It's a lovely family, on display for everyone, but especially the jurors. The next witness is the medical examiner, a forensic pathologist named Dr. Glover, a veteran of these battles. Because my career has involved a number of grisly murder cases, Dr. Glover and I have tangled before in front of juries, indeed in this very courtroom. He conducted an autopsy on Sean King the day after he died and has photos to prove it. A month ago, Mancini and I almost came to blows over the autopsy photos. Normally, they're not admitted because their gruesomeness is so prejudicial. However, Max convinced Goslow that three of the milder ones are probative. The first is of Sean King, lying on the slab, naked but for a white towel over his midsection. The second is a close-up of his face with the camera directly above him. The third is of his shaved head, turned to the right to reveal considerable swelling from several incisions. The 20 or so photos wisely excluded by Goslow are so graphic that no sane trial judge would allow the jury to see them. Sawing off the top of the skull, tight photos of the damaged brain, and the last one of the brain sitting alone on a lab table. The ones deemed admissible are projected on a tall, wide screen. Mancini walks the doctor through each one. The cause of death was blunt force trauma, inflicted by repeated blows to the upper face. How many blows? Well, we have the video to show us. This is another smart move by Max to introduce the footage with the medical expert on the stand. The lights go dim, and on the large screen we get to relive the tragedy. The two fighters in the center of the ring, both confident of victory. Sean King raises the right hand of Crush, who seems surprised. Tadeo's shoulders slump in disbelief. Then suddenly he hits Crush from the side. A real sucker punch. Before Sean King can react, Tadeo lands a hard right to his nose, then a left. Sean King falls back and lands against the wire cage, where he sits, slumped over, defenseless, out cold. And Tadeo springs on him like an animal pounding away. 22 blows to the head, Dr. Glover tells the jurors, who are mesmerized by the violence. They're watching a perfectly healthy man get beaten to death. And my idiot client thinks he'll walk. The video ends when Norberto rushes into the ring and grabs Tadeo. At that point, Sean King's chin is on his chest, and his face is nothing but blood. Crush is out cold. Chaos ensues as others scramble into the picture. As the riot breaks out, the screen goes black. Doctors tried everything to relieve the intense swelling of Sean King's brain, but nothing worked. He died 5 days later without regaining consciousness. An image of a CT scan takes the place of the video, and Dr. Glover talks about cerebral contusions. Another image, and he talks about hemorrhaging within the hemispheres. Another reveals a large subdural hematoma. The witness has been discussing autopsies and causes of death with juries for many years, and he knows how to testify. He takes his time, explains things, tries to avoid esoteric words and phrases. This must be one of his easier cases because of the video. The victim was perfectly healthy when he walked into the cage. He left on a stretcher, and the world knows why. Arguing with a true expert in front of a jury is always tricky business. More often than not, the lawyer loses both the fight and his credibility. Because of the facts in this case, I have very little credibility to begin with. I'm not willing to lose any more. I stand and politely say, no questions. When I sit down, Tadeo hisses at me. What are you doing? What are you doing, man? You got to go after these dudes. Knock it off, okay, I say through gritted teeth. I'm really tired of his arrogance, and he's obviously distrustful of me. I doubt if things will improve. Chapter 23. As we break for an afternoon recess, I get a text message from Miguel Zapata. I've seen him in the courtroom throughout the morning, one of several relatives and friends clustered in the back row, watching intently, but from as far away as possible. We meet in the hallway and stroll outside. Norberto, the former manager of Team Zapata, joins us. Partner follows at a distance. I make sure they understand that Tadeo is refusing a very good plea bargain. He could be out in 18 months and fighting again. But they have a better deal. Juror number 10 is Esteban Suarez, age 38, a truck driver for a food supply company. 15 years ago, he emigrated legally from Mexico. Miguel says he has a friend who knows him. I hide my surprise as we wade into treacherous waters. We turn down a narrow one-way street with all sunlight blocked by tall buildings. How does your friend know him? I ask. Miguel is a street punk, a low-end drug runner for a gang that's heavily involved with cocaine smuggling, but not heavily involved with its profits. In the murky chain of distribution, Miguel and his boys are stuck in the middle with no room to grow. This is where Tadeo was when we met less than 2 years ago. Miguel shrugs and says, "My friend knows a lot of people." "Well, I'm sure he does. And when did your friend meet Mr. Suarez? Within the past 24 hours? "It doesn't matter. What matters is the fact that we can deal with Suarez, and he's not that expensive. Bribing a juror can lead you in the same pen with Tadeo. Señor, please, for 10 grand Suarez hangs the jury, maybe even gets an acquittal. I stop walking and stare at this small-time thug. What does he know about acquittals? If you think that jury is going to let your brother walk, then you're crazy, Miguel. Ain't going to happen. Okay, then we hang it. You said yourself that if they hang once, then hang twice, then the prosecutor will dismiss everything. I start walking again, slowly, because I'm not sure where we're headed. Partner trails 50 yards behind. I say, fine, go bribe a juror, but I'm not getting involved. Okay, senor, give me the cash and I'll get it done. Oh, I see. You need the money. Yes, senor. We don't have that kind of cash. Well, I don't either, especially not after representing your brother. I've forked over 30 grand for a jury consultant and 20 for a shrink, plus 20 more for other expenses. Keep in mind, Miguel, in my business I'm supposed to get paid by the client, cash fees for representation, and the client also covers all expenses. It's not the other way around. Is that why you're not fighting? I stop again and glare at him. You have no idea what you're talking about, Miguel. I'm doing the best I can with the facts I have. You guys are under some misguided notion that I can fit your brother into a big mysterious loophole in the law and walk him out of there a free man. Guess what? It ain't gonna happen, Miguel. Tell that to your hard-headed brother. We need 10,000, Rudd, and now. Too bad I don't have it. We want a new lawyer. Too late. Chapter 24. D is for donut. After another sleepless night, I meet Nate Spurio at a bakery near the university. For breakfast, he's having 2 honey-glazed filled with jelly and black coffee. I'm not hungry, so I choke down the coffee. After a few minutes of small talk, I say, "Look, Nate, I'm pretty busy these days. What's on your mind?" "The trial, huh?" "Yes." "I hear you're getting hammered. It's pretty ugly in there. You called. What's up?" "Not much. I've been asked to pass along some kind words from Roy Kemp and family. They took the girl off to rehab someplace. She's a mess, obviously, but at least she's safe and with her family. I mean, look, Rudd, these people thought she was dead. Now they got her back, they'll do whatever it takes to make her whole again. And they might have a lead on the baby. This thing is still unfolding all over the country. More arrests last night, more girls taken into custody. They got a tip related to the baby-selling angle, and they're all over it." I nod, take a sip, say, "That's good." "Yes, it is, and Roy Kemp wants you to know that he and his family are very grateful to you for getting the girl back and making all this happen. He kidnapped my child." "Come on, Rudd." "His daughter was kidnapped, so he must know how it feels. I don't care how grateful he is. He's lucky I called off the FBI, or he might be sitting in jail." "Come on, Rudd, let it go. There's a happy ending here, thanks to you." "I deserve nothing, and I want no part of it. Tell Mr. Kemp to kiss my butt." "Will do. They got a lead on Swanger. Last night a tip from a bartender in Racine, Wisconsin." "Great. Can we meet in a week or so and have a beer? I'm rather preoccupied right now." "Sure." Chapter 25. I huddle with partner and Cliff in the hallway before the trial resumes Friday morning. At this point, Cliff's job is to sit in various places among the spectators and watch the jurors. His reaction to yesterday is not surprising. The jurors have no sympathy for Tadeo, and they've made up their minds. "Grab the plea deal if it's still on the table," he keeps saying. I tell him about my conversation with Miguel the day before. Cliff's response, "Well, if you can bribe one, you better do it quick." As the jury files in, I steal a look at Esteban Suarez. I plan to just glance at him quickly, as I normally do during trials. However, he's gawking at me, as if he expects me to hand over an envelope. What a goofball! There's little doubt, though, that someone has made contact with him. There's also little doubt that he can't be trusted. Is he already counting his money? Judge Fabineau says good morning and welcomes everyone back to her courtroom. She goes through the standard routine of quizzing the jurors about any unauthorized contact with sinister people, hoping to sway them. I glance back at Suarez. He's staring at me. I'm sure others are noticing this. Mr. Mancini stands and announces, "Your Honor, the state rests. We may have additional witnesses for rebuttal, but for now we'll rest." This is not surprising because Max gave me a heads up. He's called only two witnesses because that's all he needs. Again, the video says it all, and Max is wise to let it speak for itself. He's clearly established the cause of death, and he certainly nailed the perpetrator. I walk to the jury box, look at everyone but Suarez, and begin by stating the obvious. My client killed Sean King. There was no premeditation, no planning. He hit him 22 times, and Tadeo doesn't remember it. In the 15 or so minutes before he attacked Sean King, Tadeo Zapata was struck on the face and head a total of 37 times by Crush, also known as Bo Fraley. 37 times. He wasn't knocked out, but he was mentally impaired. He remembers little past the second round when Crush landed a knee to his jaw. We will show you, the jury, the entire fight. Count the 37 blows to the head and prove to you that Tadeo did not know what he was doing when he attacked the referee. I am brief because there's not much to say. I thank them and leave the podium. My first witness is Oscar Moreno, Tadeo's trainer and the man who first saw his potential as a 16-year-old boxer. Oscar is about my age, older than Tadeo's gang, and he's been around the block. He hangs out in a gym for Hispanic kids and offers to train the more talented ones. He also happens to have a clean record, a real asset when calling witnesses to the stand. Past criminal convictions always come back to bite you. Juries are tough on felons under oath. With Oscar, I lay the groundwork for the events leading up to the fight. It's an effort to appeal to the jury's sense of compassion. Tadeo is a poor kid from a poor family whose only real chance in life has been inside the cage. We finally get around to the fight, and the courtroom lights go down. The first time through, we watch the fight without interruption. In the semi-darkness, I watch the jurors. The women are turned off by the sport's brutality. The men are thoroughly engrossed. During the rerun, I stop the tape each time Tadeo takes a shot in the face. The truth is that most of these were not that damaging, and Crush scored only minor points with them. But to jurors who don't know any better, a punch to the face, especially one blown out of proportion by Oscar and me, becomes a near-lethal blow. Slowly, methodically, I count them. When they are displayed in such exaggerated manner, one can easily ask how in the world Tadeo stayed on his feet. With 120 to go in the second round, Crush is able to yank Tadeo's head down and bang it into his right knee. It's a nasty shot, all right, but one that hardly fazed Tadeo. Now, though, Oscar and I make it look like the cause of permanent brain damage. I stop the video after the end of the second round, and through carefully rehearsed questions and answers, I elicit from Oscar his impressions of his fighter between rounds. The kid's eyes were glazed over. He could only grunt, not speak. He was unresponsive to questions fired at him by Norberto and Oscar. He, Oscar, thought about waving the ref over and stopping the fight. I would put Norberto on the stand to verify these lies, but he has two felony convictions and would be humiliated by Mancini. Left unsaid in this testimony is the fact that I was also in the corner. I was wearing my bright yellow Tadeo Zapata jacket and trying to act as though I was somehow needed. I have explained this to Max and Go Slow and assured them that I saw and heard nothing crucial. I was just a spectator, thus I cannot be considered a witness. Max and Go Slow know I'm here out of love and not money. We watch the third round and count more blows to Tadeo's head. Oscar testifies that when the fight was over, Tadeo thought he had one more round. He was out of it, barely conscious but still on his feet. After he attacked Sean King and was pulled off by Norberto and others, he was like an enraged animal, unsure of where he was or why he was being restrained. 30 minutes later, as he was changing in the dressing room while the police watched and waited, he began to come around. He wanted to know what the cops were doing there. He asked who won the fight. All in all, not a bad job of creating some doubt. However, even a casual viewing of all three rounds clearly shows a fight that was fairly even. Tadeo dished out as much damage as he absorbed. Mancini gets nowhere on the cross. Oscar sticks to the facts he's created. He was there in the corner talking to his fighter, and if he says the kid took too many shots to the head, so be it. Max can't prove otherwise. Next, I call our expert, Dr. Tazelman, the retired psychiatrist who now works as a professional witness. He wears a black suit, crisp white shirt, tiny red bow tie, and with his horn-rimmed glasses and long, flowing gray hair, he looks incredibly smart. I slowly walk him through his qualifications and tender him as an expert in the field of forensic psychiatry. Max has no objections. I then ask Dr. Tazelman to explain, in layman's terms, the legal concept of volitional insanity, the standard adopted by our state decades ago. He smiled at me, then looked at the jurors in much the same way an old professor would enjoy chatting with his adoring students. He says, "Volitional insanity means simply that a person who is mentally healthy does something wrong, and at the time he knows it's wrong, but at the moment he's so mentally unbalanced, so deranged he cannot prevent himself from doing it anyway. He knows it's wrong, but he cannot control himself, and thereby commits the crime." He's watched the fight many times and the video of its aftermath. He has spent a few hours with Tadeo. During their first meeting, Tadeo told him he did not remember the attack on Sean King. Indeed, he remembered virtually nothing after the second round. However, during later sessions, Tadeo seemed to recollect certain things that happened. For example, he said he remembered the smug look on Crush's face as his arm was raised in victory. He remembered the crowd screaming its disapproval of the decision. But he remembered nothing to do with the assault on the referee. Regardless, though, of what he remembered, he was blinded by emotion and had no choice but to attack. He'd been robbed, and the nearest official was Sean King. Yes, in Dr. Tazelman's opinion, Tadeo was so deranged he could not stop himself. Yes, he was legally insane, and therefore unaccountable for his actions. And there's another quite unusual factor in play here that makes the case unique. Tadeo was in a cage designed for fighting. He had just spent 9 long minutes trading punches with another fighter. He makes his living punching people. To him, at that crucial moment, it was okay to settle the matter with more punches. Put in context and in the environment of that instant, he felt as if he had no choice but to do what he did. When I'm finished with Tazelman, we break for lunch. Chapter 26. I stop by domestic relations to check the court file. As expected, old Judge Leaf has denied Judith's request for an emergency hearing and has scheduled the matter 4 weeks from now. His order also states that regular visitation will continue unchanged. Take that, sweetheart. Cliff, partner, and I walk a few blocks to a diner and hide in a booth for a quick sandwich. The morning's testimony could not have gone better for Tadeo. All three of us are surprised at how well Oscar did on the stand and how believable he was in telling the jurors that Tadeo had been knocked out but was still standing. Few fight fans would believe that, but there are none on our jury. For $20,000, I expected Dr. Tazelman to perform admirably, and he did. Cliff says the jurors are thinking now, with some doubt firmly planted. However, an acquittal is impossible. A hung jury is still our only chance, and it could be a long afternoon as Mancini goes after our expert. Back in court, Max begins by asking, "Dr. Tazelman, at what moment did the defendant become legally insane?" There's not always a clear beginning and ending. Obviously, Mr. Zapata became furious over the judge's decision awarding the fight to his opponent. So, before that moment, he was insane by your definition? It's not clear. There's a strong likelihood that Mr. Zapata had been mentally impaired during the last few minutes of the fight, but this is a very unusual situation, and it's not possible to know how clearly he was thinking before the decision was announced. It's pretty obvious, though, that he snapped quickly. How long was he legally insane? Oh, I don't think it's possible to say. Okay, under your definition, when the defendant whirled around and struck Sean King with the first punch, was that an assault? Yes. And punishable by some standard? Yes. And excusable, in your opinion, because of your definition of legal insanity? Yes. You've seen the video many times. It's clear that Sean King made no effort to defend himself once he fell to the deck and was sitting against the cage, right? That appears to be the case. Do you need to see it again? No, not at this time. So, after only two punches, Sean King is down and out, unable to protect himself, right? That appears to be the case, yes. 10 punches later, his face is bleeding and basically pulverized. He cannot protect himself. The defendant has hit him 12 times around the eye and forehead. Now, at that point, doctor, was the defendant still legally insane? He could not control himself, so the answer is yes. Mancini looks at the judge and says, "Okay, I want to run the video again in slow motion." The lights are dimmed yet again, and everyone stares at the large screen. Max runs it in super slow-mo and announces loudly as each punch lands, "One, two, he's down now, 3, 4, 5. I glance at the jurors. They may be tired of this footage, but they're still captivated by it. Max stops with blow number 12 and asks, "Now, doctor, you're telling this jury that they're looking at a man who knows he's doing wrong, violating the law, but cannot physically or mentally stop himself. Is that right?" Max's tone is one of incredulity and mockery, and it's effective. What we're watching is a slaughter by one PO'd fighter, not a man driven insane. "That's correct," Dr. Tazelman says, not yielding an inch. This concludes another reading of Rogue Lawyer by John Grisham, published by Doubleday of New York. We're quickly approaching the end of this, the last Radio Reader book. If you'd like to send best wishes to Dick Estelle, contact information is available on the Radio Reader website at radioreader.net. Join me next time for another reading of Rogue Lawyer. I'm Bob Page for Dick Estelle's Radio Reader from Michigan State University.